seated. Court is ready to hear similar argument in 070639 Don's Building Supply versus One Beacon Insurance Company.
May it please the court, Mr. Allman will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, I think we're up to our 32nd through 40th corners if I multiply eight corners times five cases over 2 days, all addressing similar issues, speaking to one. We don't have cell phones today, although if I may speak for just a moment as amicus curiae, I would suggest to the court that the mental anguish I feel when my children's cell phone bills are opened does constitute bodily injury under any standard.
But is it biological injury? That's the question.
It certainly is, Your Honor. I used to be 6'4". With that said, we address today the same questions you've just heard. So let me take this on from the perspective that the court has addressed it. And I think that the recent opinion that the court issued in the Franks casing matter helps us address how to parse the issues before it. In that opinion, it's slip opinion, and it came out at page 6 on my computer. The court noted that insureds purchase insurance to deal with two kinds of things. One as risk, one are risks. Risks are losses. So that's an indemnification duty. But the other thing that insureds purchase insurance for is to hedge against litigation costs, which is a separate set of costs. In the world of insurance, the insurers control the risks they are willing to assume, that is to say, those kinds of cases they are willing to indemnify an insured for, and they are also in charge of picking out the kinds of litigation costs they wish to assume. So when we look at this case, which is a duty to defend case, we are looking at the insurer's choices as to the kinds of litigation costs it wished to pick up.
But when damages occur is going to be the same for a duty to defend and for indemnification.
Not quite, Your Honor, if I may disagree slightly. On the litigation risk side, the point is it's the potential for them to occur during that period of time.
We'll still have the same rule, though.
I think that's right, but I think that the level of proof is different. So we look to the choices that the insurer made.
Well, I understand the level that we're looking at eight corners versus proof in the end, but we still need to know when do damages occur.
And the answer is we look to the language of the policy that the insurer picked. And you will notice that all of the things that have been told to the court, that they occur when they manifest, or that property damage occurs when it manifests, or a lot of it manifests, or all of it manifests, or it's enough that someone trips and falls and sustains an actual injury, all of those are perfectly acceptable choices in theory. But none of them are included in this policy. The only rule we're getting...
That's the part I don't understand, because it seems to me that just saying that... injury, in fact, is the only thing in the policy, does not help us understand when that injury is actually there. Is it when you put the siding up and it can leak? Is it the first time it leaks? Is it later on when it leaks and starts hurting things? When is it?
Then let's look to the facts that are alleged against us and use them as the clinic to answer those questions. Here, Don's is alleged to be the distributor of this siding material. So we're not the builders. We don't have some of the Lamar Homes issues. We are alleged to have distributed a defective product. It's applied to the home at some point, according to the petitions, which we must accept as true, within 6 months to a year thereafter, it cracks. Now, the 22 petitions I have all have installation dates during the period of the One Beacon policy. So under the court's decision in Lamar Homes, there is property damage alleged during the policy period right there. But let's go on because that's not
true. I want you to refine it for me. Is it when you put the siding up?
It is not when you put the siding up.
Okay, when is it?
It is when the siding cracks. That's the first time.
Okay, when it actually cracks?
Yes, sir. That's
when,
the first moment. There's
or
more.
When it's likely to crack?
No, when it cracks. Not when it's likely to crack, when it cracks.
And not when you see it crack.
Right. I may not see it. I may have a defective roof, But it may be two stories up, and I can't get up there to get on a ladder to see it. But it's still defective, and it's still cracked.
And if the crack is on the side of the house, 5 feet high, where you could see it, but it's internal, but it's not external so that you can see it, then what?
It is still actual injury.
And what if it's neighbors, two neighbors, and you look to your neighbors, same siding on both houses, 6 months apart, you see that your neighbor's siding is defective?
Then I have...
It hasn't cracked on your house yet.
The answer to that is, at that point, I have some obligation to investigate, and that investigation may reveal that there's actual injury in existence or on the way. But that's not the timing. The fact that my neighbors have a hurt doesn't mean that I'm hurt. It's when it cracks on my house. But that's just the beginning, because it continues. The suit papers here allege that once the cracks are there, water gets in behind the eaves. Now, common sense tells us that water shouldn't be behind the outside of my house. I don't have to ask whether raining on a structure is in itself damages. When my house is built and water's getting in from the outside where it shouldn't, that's wrong. But that's what's alleged here, that water got in every time it rained, and that every time it got in, it got behind the eaves, and it began to damage other pieces of property inside the house.
Let me ask a question there. We heard last argument that once you get water on raw wood, you start having damage. Does that make a difference on a duty to defend, whether it did or did not have damage, if they alleged that it was damaged?
There's two ways to address that, Your Honor. The first is to say that's not alleged here, so I didn't think about it. But the more obvious one is that if I was alleged to have allowed construction materials to sit outside and get wet improperly so that they could rot and ultimately become defective or cause other damage, that might be so. But here there's no such allegation. The point is, the allegation here is the product's defective, it cracks, it lets water in. Water started to come in, according to the plaintiffs, and I should say for the record, we dispute the allegations, but they have to be taken as true.
You say property damage occurs each one of those places?
Every time there's a crack and every time there's a rain.
So you disagree with counsel in the opposing case that said if property damage occurs during our coverage period, we have to cover everything. You think that's not true?
I believe that
they only have to cover the... So if cracks develop over a three-year period,
sure.
Then each, and there's three different insurers for each year, then this one covers these cracks, and this one covers these cracks, and this one covers these cracks.
Now, not under the court's existing precedent, in APIE versus Garcia at page... 854, I believe, the court said that the insurer's obligation was several. It is at 854. The insurer's obligations are several, so that the insured was allowed to pick an individual insurer who would become responsible for paying that loss and being in charge, as it were. And then that individual insurer might have rights over against other insurers, depending upon their contractual situation. So the answer is that the law so far in this state is a little bit different. To get back to the point...
But property damage occurs whenever the plaintiffs want it to.
I would hope not, from a defense lawyer standpoint.
You just said they could pick one. You just said they're all...
If I can finish... I'm sorry, Your Honor.
You just said all of them are property damage, and the plaintiff can pick whichever one they want.
No, the insured picks under Garcia, Your Honor. If the insured has more than one...
Don't look to the petition.
Once it's established under the petition that more than one policy may apply, the insured, under the Garcia opinion, has the right to determine which carrier should take the lead at this point. That's not in dispute in this case.
So the insured picks when property damage occurs.
The insured picks the carrier.
Picks when property damage occurs.
No, because by definition, the insured has options and the property damage occurred in more than one location. The point is that if the property damage occurs in your three-year cycle, there's property damage under each of the three policies using this definition. Each is potentially responsible, and the issue becomes, how do we then allocate the burdens among them, something that is not in dispute in this case because we only have one insurer who didn't respond. That's for another day. But right now, as of this, and Garcia addresses that, but in this case, at this time, the policy that was written, the standard policy said, if it occurs, if it takes place or happens in our period, we're responsible for it. So under the Eight Corners rule, if it potentially occurred during our policy period, we will defend you. Now, why would we go to occurs? It was brought up in the prior argument. We use the word manifest, and it comes up often. But the drafters of this policy got rid of the word manifest several years before this policy was brought into the world.
Could I be clear about something else?
Yes, sir.
And that is, you were here in the last argument, and the respondent's position is that once damage occurs, it's that insurer's responsibility and not any subsequent insurer's responsibility.
The policy-driven answer is to say that that may be so and it may not be so. If there's different damage at different times, multiple insurers may be responsible as well.
In this case, leaking siding that causes wood rot.
There may be more cracks. There may be more leaks. I can foresee
every crack, every leak, every rain.
The other answer to that goes back to the drafter's answer to that question. These hypotheticals or ones like them were run by the drafters of this policy, the guys who wrote it. And one of them was run by it, and it's contained in our brief at page 18, was a situation where acid is poured down a drain over a period of 3 years, as it happens, without anybody knowing that. And under the language that we see before us today, the drafters of the policy said each of the three policies in effect during that period of time would be responsible for the damages. So the deemer, what you're hearing is called in the trade a deemer clause. Everything is deemed to happen as of a certain date. And in fact, this policy has deemer clauses in it. The loss of use definitions that are contained in the policy say that all loss of use from property that's not physically injured shall be deemed to occur on a particular date or time. So there are contractual ways of compressing all of this so that one policy can take care of it. But that option was not chosen here. It's not in this policy.
Well,
You said the policy drafters also, once upon a time, used the word manifest, but then scrapped it.
Yes. The reason they did so, Your Honor, was because they could not answer the question that Justice Wainwright posed to last counsel. Manifest to whom, when, and how? The problem with putting a manifestation trigger here is that we see that what may be identifiable too often is subjective rather than objective. And remembering that I buy insurance as a hedge against litigation costs, why should my ability to get something I've paid thousands of dollars for depend upon subjective impression of somebody else? Don's didn't go out to these houses. We aren't alleged to have installed this stuff. So we're having to depend for our insurance upon someone else's impression or when two people later on decide that it was reasonable to have
seen. How is injury, in fact, any less subjective? How is pegging a specific time when injury, in fact occurred any less subjective?
It really isn't because, although it could be argued so, it undoubtedly will be, the difference is this. For the underlying claimant to prevail in their tort action, they're going to have to prove causation and damages. So they're going to have to prove the injury and causation and damages as a part and parcel of their underlying claim. So that gets attended to by the fact that it's going to be resolved as part of the underlying lawsuit. And we don't rely, good heavens, I hope quite the contrary, they don't win. But the point I make to you is, Your Honor, is that that during that underlying lawsuit, these issues get discussed as a matter of course in order to establish a cause of action and get to the jury.
I was not clear about your position on the situation where a homeowner buys the home after the policy period, but there has been damage to the home before that. do you contend that that is covered by?
Yes, I do. In the two cases, there's no. This case is the Don's Union case, and Union filed an amicus brief advancing, previewing this issue the day before yesterday. The two most important cases on point are the Huang, H-O-A-N-G case out of the Colorado Supreme Court, which was handed down in January of 2007, holding that it didn't matter whether the purchase was there, and the Tufts University case that comes from Massachusetts. They're both cited in various of the briefs. The point here is that this is another issue that goes to the underlying case. I may not have a cause of action as a subsequent purchaser, but Don's bought a hedge against litigation costs for claims that could potentially be covered.
Any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. The
court is ready to hear argument from the appellee.
May it please the court, Mr. Creeley will present argument to the respondent.
May it please the court, good morning. As the court knows from reviewing the briefs, we are dealing with one key pivotal issue, and that is what is the appropriate trigger to be applied in the context of construction defect claims, such as the underlying EPIS claims. We're not dealing with bodily injury claims, like the alleged cell phone injury claims that you heard yesterday, so we're not dealing with issues of whether or not the pleading sufficiently alleged bodily injury, whether or not the plaintiff was actually harmed, or the related trigger issue of when the plaintiff was harmed. This is also not an environmental case, and it's also not an asbestos property damage case. This deals with coverage for construction defect claims. I want to get
They have similar facts to those type of cases when you don't know exactly when the damage occurs. If it's a continuing damage, it's a...
That can be true, but courts recognize that there's a different injury-causing process and different resulting harm. And I believe Justice Heck was right on the money when he says... In this case, in a construction defect case, manifestation goes to when there is damage. And that's what triggers serve to serve. They're rules employed as a matter of policy construction to determine when a claimant has been damaged. Why is that important? Well, there's a basic tenet of liability coverage that is not when the insured's conduct was performed or when an injury-causing event or process occurs, but it's when the claimant suffers injury or damage. That determines which policy has to respond. In other words, which policy is triggered.
And what do you do with the problems inherent in manifestation? To whom, when, how much? One might seem simpler at one level, and another might seem simpler at another level. I mean, it's easier for me to get my mind around damage occurs when the water intrudes, regardless of when it manifests.
Well,
but it's also easy to put all the policies under a manifestation rule, but determining what's manifestation is difficult.
Well, I'm not saying that manifestation is without certain issues, but it makes sense when you consider the relevant policy language. There's a little bit of misdirection going on here, in my opinion. I have a different view. Don's counsel, the counsel in the prior case, have been focusing on what I call the sub-requirement, that the property damage must occur during the policy. But you can't consider that in isolation. That's only part of the analysis. You must look at the insuring agreement. And I know this may sound odd, but liability coverage does not cover property damage in the abstract. It covers liability for damages suffered by a claimant due to property damage. And so there has to be some nexus between the loss suffered by the claimant and the policy period. And that's what the trigger rules seek to determine. And in the context of a construction defect claim, it makes particular sense. Because until there has been manifestation of a problem, the plaintiff has not been harmed. There's been no loss of use. There's been no loss of function. There's been no loss of appearance. He's not been harmed. And that's why I believe Justice Hecht is correct. Manifestation, to quote him, goes to what is damaged, but also goes to the timing of the damage suffered by the claimant, which is a requirement under the basic tenet of liability insurance.
Do you agree with the respondent in the earlier argument that once damages occur, that's the insurer who must respond as opposed to subsequent insurers?
I look at it a little differently. It's when the claimant has been injured or damaged. That's That dictates which policy has to respond.
All right, but the petitioner argues that every time it rains is new damage.
I know that's the petitioner's position.
And what's your response to that?
Again, whether, let's say, let me clarify one thing. First of all, the allegations don't allege cracks. Basically, the allegations say that within 6 months to a year after after construction, there was a failure of the seals of the EFIS system that allow water to collect behind the panels. Okay? The fact that there may be, and again, there are a whole host of medical physical questions, the ones that are raised in my question, some of which have been raised here today, that come into play as to when there has been, in fact, property damage. I don't want to go there. It's irrelevant. What's important is when has the plaintiff suffered injury or damage, and that is the test.
And you think that's an easier question than the one you don't want to answer?
Certainly.
I still don't understand. Their allegation is it started leaking on day one, and then at a subsequent time it leaked some more, and then at a subsequent time the wood got wet so that it's going to start rotting, and at a subsequent time it was really rotting pretty badly, and later it was rotting so badly the house is going to fall down. Now, are all of those occurrences of damages?
It's really hard for me to say. Certainly, at some point in time, and we can all debate what point in time that could be, and I think it's going to bring in a whole host of experts, and what we're trying to do here is achieve predictability and avoid undue debate. And let's face it, without some sort of relative bright-line test, it's just going to open the door to debate and controversy.
Well, but petitioner's argument is a bright-line test. The answer is all of them.
But that is not consistent with the policy language and the intent of the coverage that is there to provide coverage for liability for damages suffered by a third party because of property. That's the risk that was assumed.
Well, under your theory then, if going back to Justice Heck's scenario, you get a little damage, you get a little damage next year, a little damage after that, but we really don't have any damages until the wall falls down, because that's the first point anybody has any damages. So that would be, that would have to be your answer to that question.
That's correct. There's been no harm to the claimant until such time as
there's
a manifested problem.
If somebody goes out and the wall falls down, we know that's damage. If someone goes out and happens to hit a baseball up against the house, one of the tiles falls off or something, somebody says, whoa, there's wood rot in there. Now, is that damage? Wall hasn't fallen down. Some kind of wood rot in there.
But the problem has manifested itself. It's become evident. It's become readily apparent at that
time. But what damage is there by simply seeing it now, and we didn't see it before they hit the baseball on the house and knocked part of it off? What? How's the plaintiff been damaged under your construct here?
Well,
because the wood rot's the same whether we see it or don't see it.
But there's a difference because it affects the value of the property. There's a difference between property that has a latent defect that hasn't been made manifest or become evident, and that which has.
Not if they just put that siding back up there. There's not any damage to the property, but the plaintiff knows about it, but hadn't structurally damaged it or anything like that. Now we know about it, but there's no structural harm yet. It's just wood rot. Under your scenario, still no damage to the plaintiff, although we know there's property damage in there. It seems like we have to get that conclusion if we follow your line of thinking.
Well, until such time, there at the earliest, there would have not have been any damage before that time. Because there was no knowledge of a problem. It didn't affect the function or the use, enjoyment, or the appearance, or the value of the property.
So is there damage to the plaintiff that puts it back up on the siding back up, sells the house, walks off? Has the plaintiff been damaged?
Well, I suggest that may present
other
liability
problem,
to the plaintiff.
I'm asking you, has the plaintiff been damaged, even though there's damage to the house, no economic damage to the plaintiff, has the plaintiff been damaged under your construct? Has there been damage?
I'm not quite sure how to answer that, Your Honor, because we have to look at the pleadings of the claimant, and that gets to another issue in this case. We have to see what the plaintiffs are actually alleging in terms of what damage they've suffered, when it was manifested. And that gets to the specific pleadings in this case. Another issue in this case is what is the appropriate standard? And kind of gets to Justice O'Neill's question. And I know this court is aware that there's a substantial body of Texas law out there. And every one of the cases, with the exception of Pine Oak, which adopts an exposure trigger, and doesn't really deal with this issue about when the claimant
exposure,
in that case,
I mean,
yes, it adopted an exposure trigger. That's a rule that's that has been applied to bodily injury cases. It's the only one I know of that applies an exposure trigger in a property damage case. All other Texas courts, including alumni of this court, have concluded that a manifestation trigger is appropriate in the context of a construction defect claim. And in those cases, they have adopted, as have the courts in other jurisdictions that have adopted a manifestation trigger, the standard for manifestation. That is, when does the property become manifested? When it becomes reasonably apparent, when it's easily capable of being perceived, recognized, or understood. And that's the standard that we ask this court to adopt. Now, with that in mind, it gets to the pleadings in this particular case. We're dealing with 22 lawsuits, and the pleadings are basically identical. And by the way, as an aside, getting back to Justice Heck's inquiry regarding the subsequent purchaser issue, there are at least three lawsuits that involve a subsequent purchaser: Jackson, Kantz, and Walters. So that issue is in this case, and of course it's also in the Dons versus Union Standard case. But in all those cases, they have included what I call discovery slash manifestation allegations. And why they include both discovery and manifestation allegations, I don't know. But they don't just allege that the problem wasn't discovered and could not have been discovered in the exercise of reasonable diligence. But they go beyond that. They say it wasn't manifested, it was latent, inherently undiscoverable, was not readily apparent, and not capable of being easily recognized, which is the standard for manifestation.
You say we need a bright line test that's consistent with the policy language. And my question is, I mean, how's manifestation, how does that track and honor the policy language? It may be easy and simple to apply, or maybe simpler than the other test, but how is it consistent with the policy language?
Well, again, the policy language focuses on damages suffered by a claimant because of property damage. And these rules are employed for persons occurring when the claimant has been injured. And there are treatises that deal with these different trigger rules and the pros and cons, the benefits, the disadvantages. There has to be a resulting injury, and that is the trigger. And where you call it injury in fact, or in this case manifestation. In fact, let me talk about some of the cases in the other jurisdictions. If you limit it to coverage cases dealing with trigger in a CD context in the other jurisdictions, there's really no disagreement. I mean, there is disagreement. There's no agreement. There are many cases that apply manifestation, and there are other cases that apply injury in fact. But when you look at those injury in fact cases in a CD context, when I say CD context, I'm talking about construction defect context, they focus on when was there a resulting injury to the plaintiff. And in fact, many of those cases apply, in effect, a manifestation trigger as an approximation of when the plaintiff suffers damage, or the earliest point when a plaintiff suffers damage. In fact, there are a couple of cases, they're signed in the brief, that says manifestation in CD context is the functional equivalent of injury in fact. Again, the key is when was there resulting injury or damage to the plaintiff.
Ascertainable injury. So sort of out of sight, out of mind, out of the policy, but once you see it, then you've suffered injury. Is that your view?
Sort of, although this concept of resulting injury is in the policy.
Do you agree with counsel from the last argument that if we adopted a manifestation rule, it would have, sometimes it would favor insureds and sometimes the insurers and vice versa?
Oh, absolutely.
Let me ask one question about that. Wouldn't it be more advantageous to the insured to have policy coverage over multiple years? If you're just talking about 1 year of coverage, you might not have enough coverage to insure the claim.
Not necessarily so. You may have periods of uninsured exposure. You may have periods of self-insured exposure. So,
it but if you have three policy years, insurers all contributing to to adjust the claim, it seems like assuming that you've purchased insurance throughout the entire period, that you've got more, in effect, more coverage, more ability to have that loss remedied.
I guess there's some logic to that, but what we're talking about is construing the policy at hand.
I was just asking the question about favoring the insured or the insurer.
Well,
if that even matters, I don't know.
Well, let me address that a little further as it relates to my client. First of all, my client did not make the decision to stand on the manifestation trigger in this context lightly. And let's forget the fact that there's 20 to 30 Texas cases that have routinely applied the manifestation trigger in a CD context. Because, as you have suggested, may help my insurer in this case, but it could come back to bite them in the next. It handles a lot of construction defect claims. And so it has adopted the manifestation trigger because it believes it's a pragmatic rule. It's a common sense rule. It affords predictability. And it certainly is consistent with the intent of the coverage in light of the relevant policy terms, particularly the insuring language that focuses on damages suffered by the third party because of property damage, as well as concerning the nature of CD claims and the resulting damage. And so that's why my client has adopted a manifestation trigger, knowing that it may hurt them the next time.
Mr. Alleman said that the word manifestation was deleted from these policies years ago. That seems to be pretty significant to me. What's your response?
Well, I know he's referring on so-called drafting history, and I don't know if the court has found a copy of that article, which was a compilation of arguments that have been made along the years. There was a proposal to include it, but it felt was unnecessary. And what's interesting about the language here, and I know my client doesn't particularly like this word, but the language is, in a sense, elegant, because it allows flexibility on how the insuring agreement is applied to different claims, whether it be bodily injury or environmental or asbestos or CD. But the key is still, when was the plaintiff harmed? And that is the test that the trigger rules seek to determine.
One difficulty with it is it's different from the accrual rule, right? Because generally we say a cause of action accrues whenever the injury occurs, regardless of whether the full damages have resulted. So for limitations purposes, don't these causes of action accrue basically when the siding was put up?
I haven't looked at that, Your Honor. I don't know. I don't have a particular position on that. Certainly, I would think that the cause of action did not accrue until the plaintiff suffered damages, because that would be part of the cause of action. And in this case, it wouldn't be until at least after manifestation.
Counsel, so your interpretation would make the policy read, this insurance applies to property damage only if the plaintiff suffers damage during the policy period. The way it reads now, as I understand it, is this insurance applies to property damage only if the property damage occurs during the policy period. Your interpretation would be only if the plaintiff is economically damaged instead of during the policy period.
Well, I think the court is seizing on the, I call it sub-requirement two, that property damage must occur during the policy period. But again, you can't consider that in isolation. You have to go to the insuring agreement itself that says that there's coverage for sums that the insured may become obligated to pay as damages because of property damage. And so, again, there has to be a nexus between the harm suffered by the claimant and the policy period. And that's what we're dealing with, and that's what trigger rules serve.
Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Otherwise, I'll reserve arguments to the briefs.
Thank you, counsel.
Is the drafting history in the record or not in the record?
May it please the court. The drafting history is contained in an article that is cited to in the reply brief. The genesis of it was the California Unified Asbestos Property Damage cases in the 1980s. Just a moment, I can give you a cite to the reply brief, which compiles the locations. The importance of the language...
It's in the reply brief,
Your Honor, and if I see it here before we leave, I will certainly pass it on. I have a sense of deja vu as I hear some of the points that are being made by counsel. When the plaintiff suffers damages, are they economic losses? Are the damages? This court dealt with that in Lamar Holmes. We see here, as we stand here today, there is a test. And all of the arguments that were made across the way could have been written into the policy. But they weren't. Even if the manifestation standard was discussed and agreed upon by the drafters, which it wasn't, this policy doesn't say that. It doesn't say when the plaintiff actually suffers damages. It doesn't say when a reasonable person would have discovered the damages. It doesn't say when the cause of action accrues. There is a conflation here of the plaintiff's discovery that they are damaged, whether they were reasonable, unreasonable, or otherwise, with the idea that that's when the damage occurred. So you're not just asked to write change occur to manifest. You're really asked to change this policy from occurred to manifest. But wait, manifest doesn't occur until they discovered it. Now, why is this? Now, if you'll notice the two people who've come to this court on behalf of the insurance companies, they are all carriers who are alleged who were on the risk when the damage was alleged to be ongoing, but before it was discovered. So there's a certain flag of convenience that's being raised by saying that it's a later trigger when it was actually discovered.
But did the people that buy the homes, their damage occurs when they buy the homes? They always plead the discovery rule because if it doesn't occur later. But there's no question it accrues, and they have to allege that they were damaged when they bought the house because they haven't had any dealings with the builder since.
With all respect, Your Honor, to most of the people here were the first purchasers, so they bought direct from the builder, all but two or three. And I don't generally dispute Mr. Creeley's comments on how many bought or sold. That's apparent from the record, and I think he's about right. The point is, it isn't whether they bought the home. That's another point that could have been put into the policy. All of these claims that are made to limit coverage are things that could have been accrued.
They have to allege the petitions, which we always look to for duty to defend. They have to allege I was damaged when I bought the house because they haven't had any dealings with the builder or the subcontractor since.
And that is exactly the point, where the allegations in the suit papers are conflicting or ambiguous as to what really happened.
Why would they be ambiguous?
I was injured. In this case, they really aren't, because the suit papers clearly say I was injured beginning 6 months to a year after this EIFS material was put on my home. Those injuries continue till today. I didn't happen to discover them.
But their suit is against a builder.
And the product distributor.
And those people didn't come out and hammer on the wall 6 months after they bought the house.
No, sir.
They were out of the picture.
But remember, I'm a product distributor. So whether or not they're a subsequent purchaser or a first purchaser doesn't matter. If my product is allegedly defective, those rights in this state have run to subsequent purchasers for many, many years.
But I'm just wondering if the rule is when you on construction defect cases, and maybe it has to be a different occurrence for every kind of category you're talking about, but construction defect cases, if damage occurs when you buy the house, that has the advantage that the insurer, whose period cover period it is, can go out and watch how you're building the houses during that year if they want to limit their liability.
The answer to that question, of course, is that in theory, on a prospective basis, an insurer could insist upon that in their policy language. But they didn't. And as a policy solution to this problem, That may well have considerable merit, Your Honor. But as a reading of a contract that was agreed to by the parties and for which they accepted thousands of dollars, it isn't the law.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Allman. The cause is submitted. That concludes the arguments for this morning, and the marshal will adjourn the court.
All rise. Oyez, oyez, oyez. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas now stands adjourned.